The smell of brewing coffee awakened Falcon the next morning. He lay in bed for a moment, thinking about the night before. It had been good. Oh, hell, it had been better than good. Frances was not only a beautiful woman, it turned out that she was a surprisingly passionate woman as well. Frances had not spent the entire night in his bed. And when he awoke this morning, he wondered for a moment if it had actually happened. Had she really come to his bed, or had it just been a dream? No, it was not a dream. She had shared his bed with him. He could still smell the hint of lilac on the pillow and in the sheets. It had not been in Falcon's plans to have an affair with Frances, especially since she had a son to raise. Falcon had no history of butting into other people's families. Falcon was not the one who initiated it. It had been Frances. And when the beautiful, passionate woman launched her campaign to get Falcon in bed, well, he found it impossible to resist her charms. Falcon swung his legs over and sat up on the edge of the bed. The first item of clothing he put on was his hat. Then he reached for the rest of his clothes. 5 minutes later, he walked into the kitchen, where he saw Frances standing over the wood-burning stove fixing breakfast.
I hope you like hotcakes.
Well, I love hotcakes.
Good.
Frances?
Yes?
Frances rubbed the back of her hand on her face, leaving a small smear of flour on her forehead.
About last night.
Stop.
Frances held up her hand.
I don't want you to get the wrong idea.
Holding the spatula in her right hand, she lifted her hand to rub her face, and she left another mark of flour on her forehead.
The wrong idea?
Yes, the wrong idea. I like you, Falcon. I like you a lot. But I have a responsibility to me son. What happened last night, what we did last night, has to stay right here. We can't carry it any further. I just can't get married again. I hope you understand.
Falcon nodded slowly.
I understand.
Good. What we had between us last night was beautiful. Like a flower that blooms and lives but one day. That's the way it has to be with us, Falcon. We should never do this again. We can't ever do it again.
Falcon felt a sense of relief. He didn't want to be involved with any woman. He wasn't in a position to be. He had too many enemies, and when his enemies came after him, they weren't all that discriminating. The experience with his own wife, Mary, had proven that.
You do understand, don't you?
I do.
Oh, I'm glad. Now, have a seat. The hotcakes will be ready soon.
From the Sentinel. City celebration marred by brutal slaying. Evening of beautiful music ruined by a madman. Gunshots fill the street. Slayer is himself slain. By James Hayford, publisher. On Friday last, the citizens of our fair town were entertained by a young woman whose singing voice can only be compared to that of the angels, heralding some glad tidings from above. All left the theater imbued with the spirit of joy over having been witness to such beautiful singing as performed by Miss Kathleen Coyle. But alas, our fair city was not long to relish this state of joy and contentment. Indeed, a scent of sulfur permeated the very air when a brigand by the name of Gilly Cardus, recently escaped from prison in Yuma, Arizona territory, saw fit to bring evil upon us, brutally killing Paul Mobley, an innocent young man employed as a stagehand for the theater. Cardus then fled from the theater, being pursued by Deputy Seth Joyner and Mr. Falcon McAllister, a visiting cattleman in town for the Hereford auction, yet to be held. Fleeing to the railroad station, Cardus used a coward's cover of darkness, surprised young Deputy Sheriff Seth Joyner by shooting him at point-blank range. His exchange of shots with Falcon McAllister proved to be a fatal mistake on his part, however, for Mr. McAllister dispatched him with but one shot from his pistol. For the readers of this newspaper who are not familiar with Falcon McAllister, he is a man known throughout the West for the quickness of his gun, the unerring accuracy of his eye, and his sense of justice, seeking always to right wrong and defend the defenseless.
V Gabe Harlan and Pete Ward started through the narrow draw that led through the south range of the Laramie Mountains and into a hidden valley.
What the hell? Why are they shooting at us?
Pete pulled his horse back around the bend in the pass and out of the line of fire.
Wait a minute, Pete. Don't go in there yet.
Why not? This is where we're supposed to meet them, ain't it?
Don't you remember that Eddie Jordan gave us these pieces of red cloth to put on our hats so we can let them know who we are?
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
Uh-huh, and forgetting is what near about got your ass shot off.
The two pulled the red cloth from their saddlebags, then, as instructed, stuck the cloth down into the headbands of their hats.
Wait a minute.
Wait for what?
Gabe took the red cloth off his hat and tied it on the end of his rifle.
What are you doing that for?
I think we better let them know about the red cloth before we go in again.
Gabe walked up to the turn in the narrow draw, then stuck the rifle out around the corner and waved it up and down several times.
You think that'll do it?
I don't know. I hope so. Ride on in now, real slow.
Me ride in? Why should I?
Because you're the one that got us into this predicament in the first place. You're the one who rode in without so much as a fairly well with no red in your hat.
All right, I'll ride in, but stay out of my way. If they shoot again, I'm hightailing it out of there.
Hold your hands up as you ride in. Maybe if they see that, they'll see we're friends.
With the piece of red cloth prominently displayed on his hat, Pete rode back around the corner of the draw with his hands held up.
All right, they ain't a-shooting this time. Come on, let's go in.
Cautiously, Gabe put the red cloth back into his hat band and came into the draw behind Pete. They urged their mounts ahead and the horses picked their way through the narrow draw.
Hey, Gabe, you got you sort of a prickly feeling on the back of your neck, like we's being watched?
Of course we're being watched.
As it got closer, someone suddenly appeared, standing on top of a large overhang ahead of them. He was holding a rifle as he stared down at him. Because Pete was still leading the way, he was the only one of the two to see him.
Hold it, Gabe. Take a look up there.
Looking up, Gabe saw the man watching him. Gabe made a big show of taking off his hat and pointing to the splash of red in his hat band. The man on the rock held out his hand as if to stop him, then pulled his pistol.
What the hell is he doing?
Wait. Don't move or do nothing till he tells us to.
The man on the rock pointed his pistol into the air. The man on the rock waved his hand, motioning for him to come on in. The entrance to the hidden valley was long and twisting, and in places so narrow that it barely afforded enough space for one horse and a rider to squeeze through. When they finally emerged at the other end, they were met by Eddie Jordan, the man who had not only given them the red cloth, but had provided them with the directions on how to get there.
Hello, Eddie.
Hello, Gabe. Pete, did you have any trouble finding a place?
Nope, but I'm glad you told us about the red cloth. Otherwise, we might be lying belly down back in the draw.
Another man came up to greet him.
No might be to it. You'd be dead.
Who are you?
This here is Poke.
Poke?
You got a problem with that name?
No, I don't have a problem.
Poke here will take you to meet the boss.
Why can't you take us?
I got you in here. I don't need to hold your hand.
As Gabe and Pete followed Poke, they looked around. There had evidently been a homestead here at one time, and some of the original buildings remained. A large red barn, badly faded from years of exposure to the weather, was the biggest building noticeable. But there was also a two-story house near the barn, part of the original homestead. In addition, there were a few buildings constructed of shale rock and mud, a few more made of twigs and mud, and at least half a dozen tents and a few lean-tos. One enterprising soul had constructed a hasty saloon by stretching a plank across two empty barrels. A handful of men were standing by the makeshift bar, availing themselves of the services. A short distance away from the improvised saloon, four men were tossing horseshoes. At still another location, a few men were sitting by a fire cooking something. While at various other locations in the camp, men were engaged in activities from playing mumbly peg to just talking. And to Gabe and Pete's surprise, they saw a few women as well.
What is this place? Damn me if this don't almost look like a town.
Well, It's sort of like a town. We call it Last Chance.
But is it a real town? I mean, I see that some of the men have their wives here. Funny, though, I don't see no kids.
You don't see none, because there ain't no kids. Them women ain't wives, they're whores.
Is there a sheriff or anything like that?
Ain't got a sheriff. And I don't figure this would be too hospitable a place for a sheriff.
When they reached the original house, still the most substantial of all the buildings, Polk pointed to a hitching rail in front of the house.
You can tie your horses up here until you had your meeting.
What meeting?
Johnny likes to meet with everybody when they first come into Last Chance.
Johnny who?
Johnny Purvis. This is his house.
This looks a lot like a ranch. Did Johnny build it?
Johnny don't build nothing. He just takes what he wants or needs.
What happened to the people who built it?
Damn, you ask a lot of questions, don't you? This ain't a place where we ask questions.
Ain't he gonna ask us some questions?
Yeah, but that's different.
What's different about it?
You don't think he's gonna let just anybody ride in here, do you?
What should we tell him?
How the hell do I know what to tell him? Look, I'm just pointing out the house to you two boys. I sure as hell didn't adopt you.
Pete and Gabe watched as Polk left. Then they walked up the little rocky path that led to the house and knocked on the door.
Yeah, come in.
Gabe opened the door and the two of them stepped inside. They saw a big man sitting at the table eating beans.
Who are you?
My name's Gabe Harlan, Mr. Purvis. This here's Pete Ward.
I ain't Johnny.
I thought this was Mr. Purvis's house.
Oh, it's his house, all right. I'm his brother Carney. Johnny's out back taking a piss.
At that moment, the back door opened and a man came in. He was tall, with dark eyes and a black sweeping mustache. He had a dark scar on his left cheek.
Are you Johnny?
I'll ask the questions here. Who are you?
Well, I'm Gabe Harlan, and this is Pete Ward. If you're Johnny, we was told to tell you that Eddie Jordan talked to you about us. I don't know if you remember or anything.
Yeah, I remember.
Gabe waited for him to say something else until the pregnant pause grew uncomfortably long.
The thing is, I thought, well, that is, Eddie said you might have some kind of job for us.
Now that depends.
Depends on what?
On whether or not you can follow orders.
Who's giving the orders?
I give the orders. Do you have any trouble with that?
Gabe and Pete looked at each other for a moment before Gabe answered.
I ain't got no problem taking orders.
How about your pal here? Does he have any trouble with taking orders?
No, I ain't got a problem with that.
Good. You follow instructions and we'll get along just fine. And you'll make yourself a lot of money.
We're all for making money.
How are we going to do it?
I'm going to have a meeting this afternoon. You show up for that meeting, you'll find out everything you need to know.
We'll be there.
Good.
Johnny, these beans are in the can if you're hungry.
Thanks.
Johnny picked up the can of beans, but when he noticed that neither Gabe nor Pete had left, he stopped eating and looked up at him.
Why are you still here?
Pete and Gabe looked at each other. Then, by silent agreement, Gabe spoke for both of them.
Speaking of tonight, where are me and Pete supposed to sleep?
Where'd you sleep last night?
We just throwed us out a bedroll on the trail.
Oh. Well, that sounds like a good enough plan for me. Now go on, get.
When the two men went outside, they found Eddie waiting for them.
What do you think?
Think about what? He didn't tell us nothing.
Except we're going to have a meeting this afternoon.
Yeah. According to what I hear, he's got a job plan that's so big it's gonna make us rich.
I don't know. I counted at least a dozen men here. It's gonna take an awful lot of money to make all of us rich.
This is sort of an outlaw's roost. Everyone here is wanted by the law for one thing or another. But it don't mean that everyone here is gonna be part of what Johnny's cooking up. But the ones that is gonna make a lot of money.
That same afternoon, just after lunch, Gabe, Pete, Eddie, Polk, Carney, and several others, though not all the men in the camp, were gathered around the front of Johnny's cabin. Johnny stepped outside and looked at all of them for a moment, then nodded.
Boys, I'm about to tell you what I got planned. If you ain't interested, you walk away now.
Is there any shooting involved?
There might be.
Then I ain't sure I'm interested.
All right. Ain't nobody saying you gotta come. Anybody else not interested?
Is it true, like they're saying, that there's a lot of money to be made?
That's true.
Look here, Johnny. Whatever you got planned, it ain't going to bring the law down on us in here, is it? We got us a good thing in here.
Don't you be worrying about it, Quincy. It ain't going to bring the law in here. Now, are you staying or are you walking away? I only want men I can count on.
I'm walking away. Any of you coming with me?
Quincy looked at all the others, and while a few shifted their weight nervously from foot to foot, none of them joined him.
Fine. I wish you fellas luck, but count me out.
Johnny nodded, then waited until Quincy was out of hearing range.
All right, fellas. From this point on, you are all in on the deal.
What is the deal?
Maybe some of you boys don't know what's going on in Laramie right now, so I'm gonna tell you. There's gonna be a special auction take place in a few days, and several head of the best-blooded Hereford cattle will be sold.
That's it? We're gonna steal cows? The hell with that. Now, if I wanted to be a cowboy, I'd still be riding for $12 a month.
I didn't say we're gonna be stealing cows. What we're gonna steal is the money that's been brought into town to buy these cows.
How much money will that be?
Well, now, Conrad Coors will be there. Also, Shanghai Pierce, Alexander Swan, John Wesley Iliff, and I'm just naming a few. Now, I figure, all told, there'll be at least 50 of the richest cattlemen in the country there. And they'll probably bring, about $10,000 apiece to have ready for the auction. That's $500,000.
Johnny held up his hands to call for quiet.
Now, as you can see, that's plenty for all of us.
What's the plan?
I'll let the rest of you in on the plan as soon as I think you need to know.
How do you know all those people you said are there?
Because I got someone in town keeping me up on what's going on. When it's time to make our move, I'll know, and then I'll tell you. In the meantime, you make sure your horses are healthy and your guns are in good working order. You gotta be ready to move the minute I say the word.
Hey, Johnny, I count 10 of us here. So, what you're saying is, we'll be getting $50,000 apiece?
No. It won't be 10 people dividing $500,000. It'll be 9 people dividing $250,000.
How do you figure?
I figure because I'm taking half of whatever we get for myself.
The hell you say? If you take half of the money, I don't want no part of it.
Johnny pulled his pistol and pointed it at Metz.
Too late, Metz. You might recall I just told you that if you wanted no part of it, you should leave. And now, you can't leave. You still got a choice. You can take your share of $250,000, or you can die.
Don't be a fool, Metz. Your share of $250,000 would come to over $25,000.
$25,000? Oh, well, hell, why didn't you say so? Count me in.
Johnny continued to hold the gun pointed at Metz for a long moment, a hammer held back by his thumb. He held it for so long that the smile on Metz's face disappeared, to be replaced once again by an expression of fear. Finally, Johnny eased the hammer down and put his pistol back in his holster.
I won't be questioned again by anyone. Do I make myself clear? Do I make myself clear? Good. Now we understand each other.
You think Johnny would have killed Metz?
Yeah, he would have killed him.
I don't mind telling you, Johnny ain't the kind of man I feel easy about riding for. What do you think, Gabe?
What do I think? I think that for the kind of money we're talking about, I'd soak my pants in coal oil and ride for the devil himself.
Falcon McAllister, Alexander Swan, Shanghai Pierce, George Littlefield, Conrad Coors, and several other cattlemen We're down at the holding pens to get a look at the Herefords.
Is that what we're buying?
That's what we are buying, Shanghai. Purebred Hereford cattle.
I'll say this for them. They're a lot bigger than a longhorn. What do you think about them, George?
Gentlemen, the only practical knowledge I have gained in my ranching experience is to be able to say with certainty that a cow will have a calf.
Are they going to cost us a lot more to raise?
No, Alexander. That is the great beauty of raising Herefords. Gentlemen, it will cost us about the same amount of money to raise a Hereford as it does to raise a Longhorn, but we will get at least 3 times as much money per animal. Think about it. You can increase your profit by 300% just by changing breeds.
As the cattleman continued to examine the Herefords, Coors came over to talk to Falcon. Falcon was leaning on the fence, looking just over the top at the cows.
What do you think of them?
You had me convinced back in Miles City. When the auction starts, I'll be bidding.
I may have done too good a job in selling the concept. So many people are going to be bidding on the cows now that it's going to run the price up.
I'm sure you can afford it.
So can they. And that's the problem. We can all afford it.
Yeah, and here I am, a lamb come to the slaughter. I feel out of place with all the big boys here.
You'll probably take more money out of one of your gold or silver mines than we generate with all our ranches combined.
Well, I'm coming to the auction.
A lamb to the slaughter.
Maybe not quite that bad.
If I haven't said it before, Falcon, I'm glad you are participating. A lot of people respect you. When it gets out that you are running Herefords, it will do a lot for the cattle industry.
I'm keeping some of my longhorns, though.
Oh, I'm sure we all are. I confess to having some affection for the creatures.
Mr. McAllister?
Falcon turned to see a Baldwin man, a small stature, standing nearby, his hat in his hand.
Yeah?
My name is Revis. Glenn Revis.
What can I do for you, Mr. Revis?
I was wondering if you would sign this for me. Sort of an autograph, so to speak.
Revis held something out toward Falcon. Taking it, Falcon saw that it was a photograph of the corpse of Gilly Cardus.
What the hell is this?
It's a photo of the man you killed yesterday.
Where'd you get it?
From Dysart's Photoshop. He took a picture of the corpse and he's selling photographs for 50 cents the picture.
And people are actually buying them?
Yes, sir. They're going like hotcakes. Will you sign my picture?
No! I'm not gonna autograph the picture of a man I killed.
Falcon sharply handed the picture back.
It'd make a fine keepsake.
Go away, Mr. Revis. You heard the man. He's not going to sign it.
Revis stood for a moment longer, then nodded and left.
Has anything like that ever happened to you before?
You mean, has anyone ever asked me to sign the photograph of someone I kill? No, it hasn't, and I hope it never happens again. What's so funny?
I bet I know something else that's never happened to you before, and that you hope doesn't happen again.
What's that?
You losing a shooting match to a woman. Or at least almost losing to a woman.
That's true. She matched me shot for shot. In the end, I only beat her on time, not on shooting.
Who is she? I know you people who are really good with a gun keep up on each other. Have you ever heard of her before? Do you know her?
No, I never heard of her. And I didn't know her until I came to Laramie. But I know her now. Her name is Frances Martin, and she runs a small boarding house. I'm staying there while I'm in town.
You don't say. I didn't see the shooting match, but I heard she was quite a looker. Anything to that?
Well, she is a very pretty woman.
A pretty woman and a good shot. I'll bet you have some interesting conversations around the dinner table.
Frances was going out of her way to be formal and precise today, probably because Gordon was at the table. Falcon could understand her reasoning, but he found it sort of humorous when contrasting it with the passionate woman she was last night.
Would you like another serving of pot roast, Mr. McAllister?
No, thank you, Mrs. Martin. Everything is so delicious that I'm afraid that I ate too much. If I eat any more, I might just pop open.
Oh, that's too bad. I should have told you to save some room for some sweet potato pie.
Sweet potato pie? Well, I suppose I can find room for that.
I was hoping you could.
Mr. McAllister, would you tell me what it's like?
What it's like?
Yesterday. When you killed that bad man, what was it like?
Gordon, how could you ask such a thing?
I just want to know what it's like, Mom, that's all. I read about him in the stories. In the stories, he always says, "Get ready to eat your supper in hell." Did you ever say that to him?
Gordon, apologize to Mr. McAllister. You apologize right now, young man.
No, wait, wait. It's not like that, Gordon.
What do you mean?
Well, in the first place, I've never told anyone to get ready to eat supper in hell.
But all the stories I read...
are wrong. You want to know what it's like to kill a man?
Yeah.
It's like sticking your fingers so far down your throat, you want to throw up.
What?
The man I shot yesterday woke up just like I did. Just like everyone else did. He thought this would just be another day like every other day in his life. But it wasn't. It was the last day of his life because I took his life away from him. He may have been an evil man yesterday when I shot him, but he wasn't always evil. He was a kid once, playing games like other kids. All those memories he had of the games he played, the friends he had, the family he knew are gone now. And I took them away from him. No, Gordon, it's not glorious. It's not thrilling. It's not a good feeling at all. It's sort of a sick feeling.
Then why do you do it?
Well, it's not something I do by choice. And believe me, if I could walk away from it and never do it again, I would.
I guess I never thought about it like that. Mom? Mom, why are you crying?
Frances wiped her eyes with the hem of her apron.
I was moved by Mr. McAllister's words. Well, are you ready for your pie?
Can I have my pie later? I don't really feel like eating it right now. I think I'll go to my room.
All right. Whenever you feel ready for your pie, you can just come and get a piece.
Thanks. And Mr. McAllister, if I don't see you again today, good night.
Good night, Gordon.
Frances cut a generous piece of pie and put it on Falcon's plate.
Thanks.
And thank you for talking to Gordon like that. I wasn't sure where that conversation was leading, but I see now, and I think you did a good thing.
Don't be hard on him, Frances. Kids his age have a fascination with such things.
I know. That's why I've held off teaching him to shoot.
No, don't do that. He needs to know how to shoot, as much for his confidence and self-esteem as anything else. And it would be a shame for you not to pass on to him the skills you learned from your father.
I guess you're right.
This has to be about the best pie I've ever tasted. Frances, you not only shoot well, you are a culinary genius.
Falcon McAllister, if you ever think about me in the future, I hope that you remember more than my shooting and cooking skills.
Don't you worry about that. You've given me ample reason to remember you for far more than that.
Unfortunately, memory is all we'll have.
Johnny Purvis held up his hand to signal a stop, and the nine riders who were with him hauled back on their reins. Johnny took his canteen from the saddle pommel and took a drink, then offered it to his brother.
Thanks. Damn! That's water!
Yeah?
Why the hell did you offer me a drink of water? If I wanted water, I'd drink from my own canteen.
Or would you now? Let me have a drink.
What do you mean? You got your own water.
I said, let me have a drink.
Reluctantly, Carney handed his canteen over to Johnny. Johnny pulled the cork, sniffed it, then took a drink.
Just what I thought. Whiskey.
Johnny, what are you doing?
I'm pouring out your whiskey. All of you, any of you have whiskey? Pour it out now.
Nobody moved.
Get your canteens up and pull the cork. I'm gonna check every one, and if you got whiskey, I'm gonna pour it out myself.
You got no right to pour out my whiskey.
Oh, well, now you can keep your whiskey if you want to, Snyder.
Well, all right.
But if you keep it, you have to go back.
What?
Johnny pointed back down the trail.
If your whiskey is more important than the money you'll be getting from this job, you go on back. I don't intend to have any drunks with me when we pull this off.
Snyder glared at Johnny for a moment, then he began emptying his canteen. Others emptied their canteens as well. Only Eddie Jordan, Gabe Harland, and Pete Ward didn't.
You boys only have water?
Yeah, Johnny, I told him you wouldn't want no drinking.
Good man.
How much farther is it?
Johnny pulled out his watch and looked at it.
It's 11 o'clock now. We'll be there about 2.
What about eating? Are we gonna eat?
You got jerky, don't you?
Yeah.
And eat in your saddle.
Jerky ain't no good if you don't have something to wash it down with.
It's not my fault you don't have water. Let's get going.
Falcon was standing at the bar in the Gold Strike Saloon. There were only 4 others in the saloon at the moment, and Falcon looked at the regulator clock sitting near the piano at the back of the room. It was nearly 2. Sylvester was busy behind the bar counting money.
It's sort of quiet, isn't it?
Always is this time of day.
Looks like you had a good day yesterday.
I wish this was from one day. Yeah, but I only make a deposit once a week, and this is it.
Sylvester put the last of the money in a cloth bag. Kathleen was sitting at a table near the piano, looking at sheet music.
Kathleen, would you run this down to the bank for me?
Sure thing, Sylvester.
I'll go with you.
You don't need to. I can handle it by myself.
Falcon smiled as she walked over.
Oh, well, the way you talk, you'd think you don't want my company.
No, it's not that.
I'm going to the bank anyway. I'm going to make arrangements to make a wire transfer of some more money. This auction might cost me more than I thought, and I want to make certain I have enough cash on hand to participate.
All right. And of course, I welcome your company anytime, anywhere.
Falcon couldn't help but notice the last word was an invitation. Falcon tossed down the last swallow of his beer, then walked to the batwing doors and held one of them open for Kathleen.
Fire!
A man was running up the middle of the street.
Fire! The feed store's on fire!
The fire had already gotten a good start in the feed store, and a heavy column of smoke was climbing into the sky while fingers of fire licked up alongside of the building. Falcon and Kathleen stood beside the street for a minute, watching all the activity.
You want to go down and watch it, don't you? I can make a deposit myself. I know how all little boys enjoy a fire, and I believe that all men are little boys at heart.
No, I'd just get in the way.
Falcon looked around to see the fire engine being drawn at a gallop by a matched pair of white horses. Smoke was coming from the steam-powered pump, and one of the firemen was riding alongside the pumper. When they reached the bank, Falcon held the door open for Kathleen, and they stepped inside. There were no customers, but 2 men were standing at the front window of the bank, looking down toward the fire. Falcon had been in town long enough to have met both men when he opened an account to use for the upcoming auction. One was Gene Frazier, the owner of the bank, and the other was Claude Mitchum, the teller.
That's Mr. Dunaway's place that's on fire. He and his family live in the back. I hope his wife and children got out safely.
Even if they did, it's going to be difficult for them. Dunaway put everything he had into that store. I know because he had to borrow money from the bank to do it.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. McAllister. Miss Coyle.
There's quite a fire going on down there.
Indeed it is. It seems to be drawing the entire town down to watch it. I didn't expect we would have any customers with the fire going on. What can we do for you?
Well, Miss Coyle has come to make a deposit for the Gold Strike, and I want to arrange for a wire transfer of additional funds from my bank back in Colorado.
Yes, sir. It's a pleasure to do business with one of our visiting cattle barons. Mr. Mitchum, would you take care of Miss Coyle while I deal with Mr. McAllister?
Yes, sir.
I've never really thought of myself as a cattle baron.
Perhaps not a baron in the sense that Coors and some of the others are, but from what I know of you, you are certainly stout enough to have a seat at their table. Now, how much money do you want to...
6 masked men suddenly came rushing into the bank. All 6 had their guns drawn.
What's going on here?
Well, now, what does it look like? We've come to do a little business with you.
What kind of business do you expect to do wearing masks like that?
Banking business. We're going to be making a withdrawal today.
Falcon immediately recognized Carney's voice and large build from the fight in the saloon.
Hello, Carney.
Johnny, he knows who I am.
Hearing the other man referred to as Johnny, Falcon knew who he was, too.
Johnny Purvis? I thought you were in jail up in Miles City. Gone into bank robbing business, have you?
You know what, McAllister? You talk too goddamn much.
Johnny made a motion with his hand.
Take your pistol out of your holster.
Falcon reached for his gun.
No, wait! Gurley, you do it. Do it slow and easy-like. Just use your thumb and one finger. Drop it into that spittoon over there.
Kathleen just stood there.
I said, do it!
Reluctantly, Kathleen did as she was told. Carney pulled his mask off.
What did you do that for?
Hell, Johnny, he knows who we are and this mask itches.
You're right.
Johnny took his own mask off then. He fingered his scar and smiled as he looked at Falcon.
You know who this is, don't you, boys? This here is the great Falcon McAllister. Some say he's the best fighter there ever was. But look at where his gun is now.
We'll fire down the street. The one causing all the commotion. You started it, didn't you?
Well now, maybe you ain't quite as dumb as you look. Yeah, I set the fire. I figured it would draw the whole town down there. And it did. And I got men posted all up and down the street, so if anyone gets curious about what's going on here at this end at the bank, comes down here to have a look-see, they'll get shot.
Yeah, they'll be shot.
Johnny handed a large canvas bag to Mitchum.
You, start filling up this sack with money.
Nervously, Mitchum began scooping money out of the drawers. He dropped the money into the sack, then handed it back to Johnny. Johnny looked down into the bag.
What the hell? What are you trying to pull here? This can't be much more than a few thousand dollars.
There are $6,247 in the bag.
Go get the rest of it.
That's all there is.
Who are you?
My name is Gene Frazier. I own the bank.
Well, Mr. Gene Frazier, I don't believe that's all of it. You got lots of rich men in this town now to buy cattle. Are you telling me that they haven't opened accounts here?
Yes, they have.
Then give me their money!
You don't understand. They're all wire accounts. The money isn't here yet.
They're what?
Wire accounts.
What does that mean?
Means that their actual money is back in their hometowns, in their own banks. There won't be any money put in this bank until their home bank is notified by telegram. Then the money will be transferred here in time for the auction.
What kind of fools do you take us for? I don't know much about telegrams and the like, but I know for a goddamn fact that you can't send no money over a telegraph wire.
It's an accounting transfer only. That will allow the cattlemen to write drafts against an account which will be paid when the money has been physically moved to this bank.
What's this about, Johnny? You told us the bank could be filled with money.
Now take it easy, Poke. How the hell was I supposed to know about a wire transfer?
Gene Frazier suddenly grabbed a gun from a counter behind the teller window. He raised it to shoot, but was awkward about it. And the robbers, almost as one, turned their guns toward him. Frazier went down, bleeding from multiple gunshot wounds.
God damn! What did that dumb son of a bitch do that?
Snyder stuck his head in through the front door.
We gotta get out of here, boys! They heard the shots and some folks are coming this way! We're keeping them back, but there's only four of us!
Let's go!
Johnny and the other five men backed out of the bank with their guns pointed toward Falcon and Mitchum. As soon as the bank robbers left, Falcon reached down into the spittoon, disregarding the odorous brown ooze that was clinging to his gun and his hand, he rushed out the back door of the bank. He ran along the side of the bank building until he reached the street. Falcon began shooting at the fleeing robbers. Killed one and wounded another, knocking him from his horse, but the remaining eight managed to get away. Sheriff Gibson and several other townspeople who were down by the fire had been alerted by the sounds of gunshots coming from the bank. Now, with all the robbers in retreat, they came running up.
The bank?
Yeah.
How many were there?
10 altogether, I think.
10?
Damn, that's a small army.
Well, there's two less now. One dead, one still breathing.
Get the live one down here to the jail, then.
He needs a doctor.
Get him to the jail first, then get him a doctor. Falcon, was there anyone hurt in the bank?
They shot Gene Frazier. I think he's dead.
Several of the townspeople got the wounded man to his feet, not too gently, and brought him to the sheriff. He was holding his hand over a wound in his shoulder.
Does anyone know this man?
His name's Carney. You know him, don't you, McAllister? You beat the hell out of him the other day.
Yeah, I know him.
I heard about that fight. This is the one, huh?
Yeah.
Carney. Is that your last name or your first name?
It's just my name.
All right, that's good enough for me. After we hang you, we'll just put Carney on your grave mark.
My brother ain't gonna let you hang me.
Well, we'll just see about that. You all consider yourselves deputized, and get him the hell out of here.
As the townspeople took Carney down the street to the jail, Gibson and Falcon started back to the bank. Falcon stopped at a watering trough in front of the leather goods store next to the bank and dunked his hand and gun down into the water. His gun and hand clean, and followed the sheriff inside. Mitchum was sitting on the floor with Frazier. Kathleen was standing over by one of the tables, looking away from the body.
Is he dead?
Yes.
I don't suppose you recognized any of them, did you?
I didn't actually recognize any of them, but they called one of them Johnny. Johnny Purvis.
It was Johnny, all right.
You know Johnny?
I know him. So does Miss Coyle.
You know him, Miss Coyle?
No, I don't know him.
Well, I didn't mean to say that you actually know him. I just meant that you met him. We both met him up in Miles City.
Oh, well, that may be. Though I'm not sure that was the same person.
You do remember him, though, don't you? He broke into your room. How could you forget him?
I just wanted to put that incident out of my mind. I was pretty upset the night that man broke into my room. But now that you remind me of it, yes. Yes, I'm pretty sure that this was the same one.
And his name is Johnny Purvis?
Mm-hmm, yes, that's what he said his name was.
Well, at least we have one name to go on.
When they reached a stream of water, the bank robbers stopped to water their horses.
$6,000. That's a hell of a long way from $500,000.
Yeah. You want to tell me how much money you had when you woke up this morning? Now you have over $400.
Yeah, but we lost two men. One killed and one wounded.
How do you know one was just wounded?
Because I seen him sitting up as we was riding out.
Yeah, I saw it too.
Eddie was kneeling by the stream, filling his canteen. He stood up, corked it, then hooked it back onto his saddle pommel.
It was Carney, Johnny. He was the one that was wounded.
Think he'll tell him where last chance is?
He won't tell him anything.
How do you know?
Carney's not smart, but he's loyal. He won't tell him a thing.
You know what I think? I think we ought to hit him again.
What?
I said, let's hit him again.
Why? We done took all the money they had.
We took all they have now, but we didn't take all they're going to have. You heard that banker feller say that they would have the money in the bank in time for the auction, didn't you? We won't hit them now. We'll hit them when the money is there.
Are you crazy? You want to go back and rob the same bank a second time? Nobody be dumb enough to do that.
That's right. Nobody would be dumb enough to do it, which is just why nobody will be expecting us to come back.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that we are going to go back?
That's exactly what I'm saying. We're going back to get my brother. Then we're going back again when the money's transferred.
Whoa! Hold on there. Nobody said nothing about going back to get your brother. I can see maybe going back to get the money, but not to get Carney.
Johnny lifted the money bag.
We agreed that I'd get half the money, right?
Yeah.
Well, I won't take half. I'll take 1/8 of it, just like all of you. That means that instead of getting $400, you'll all get over $700 apiece. Now that's almost double.
What about when we get the big money?
Yeah, what about that, Johnny?
All right. Whatever we take from the bank when the cattleman's money comes in, we'll share equally. But that's only if you help me get my brother back.
I'll go along with that.
Whoa, Gabe. Are you sure you want to do this?
If you don't want to do it, Pete, don't do it. It'll just be a bigger share for the rest of us.
No, I didn't say I wasn't going to do it.
Gene Nunley got two men to help him carry the coffin outside and stand it up in front of the mortuary. The reason it took two men was because the body of the bank robber that Falcon shot was in it. Nunley hung a sign around his neck. Do you know this man? Several of the townspeople came by to view the corpse, most out of a sense of morbid curiosity, though some to see if they could identify him.
His name is Snyder. I don't know what his first name is, but I've seen him in the gold strike a few times.
The sheriff held a writing tablet and looked at it.
Yeah, I've had two others who made the same identification. One of them even supplied a first name, said his name was Jerry Snyder.
Yeah, could be. Like I say, I can't speak to his first name, but I know his last name is Snyder.
That's all I need to know. We'll get the son of a bitch buried this afternoon.
Several feet off, the Martins stood with Falcon.
Are you going to the funeral, Mr. McAllister?
Well, he won't be having a funeral, just a burial. And I plan to go to that, just as I did for Cardi's.
Would you explain why you would want to attend the burial of someone you killed?
I don't know if I can explain it. But it seems to me like the most important moment in any man's life is the moment that he dies. Snyder and I were on opposite sides of that moment, connected by a single thread, so to speak. It could have been me instead of him, and one day it may well be.
Frances was quiet for a moment. Then she nodded.
I'm glad.
Glad?
Yes. I'm glad you're not going to the burial as some sort of bizarre victory ritual. If you don't mind, Gordon and I will go with you.
Nunley didn't use the hearse for Snyder. He kept the hearse protected with a felt-lined tarpaulin cover, and each time he used it, he had to clean it before covering it up again. He didn't mind doing that for the funerals he had for the respectable people of town, but he had no intention of doing it for an outlaw like Jerry Snyder. Nailing the cover down on the unpainted wood coffin, Nunley and his gravedigger loaded the coffin onto the back of a wagon, then started through town to the cemetery. Several of the men, seeing the wagon pass, stopped and removed their hats, while the women bowed their heads, more from a sense of the fact that death comes to all than for respect for the body that lay in the plain coffin. When Nunley reached the cemetery, he saw Falcon McAllister and Francis and Gordon Martin standing by the grave that his gravedigger had already opened. He wasn't that surprised to see McAllister, for McAllister had also been there when he buried Cardis. But he was a little surprised to see the widow Frances Martin and her son Gordon there. Falcon stood by with his hat off as the coffin was lowered into the grave.
I forgot to ask you when we buried the other gentleman you killed, but would you like to say a few words over the grave?
No.
Very well. Jesse, close the grave.
Yes, sir, Mr. Nunley.
As Falcon, Francis, and Gordon were walking back to town, Sheriff Gibson came out to meet him. He was carrying a piece of paper, which he showed to Falcon.
Someone found this note this morning, Mr. McAllister.
To the people of Laramie. I killed this man to get your attention. If you do not release my brother by sundown today, I will kill another of your citizens. And I will kill one citizen every day until my brother is free. Johnny Purvis.
What does he mean? He killed a man to get our attention.
It was Tui Keith, Ms. Martin. A note was found lying on his chest. His throat had been cut.
Oh, no. Tui never hurt a soul.
Tui Keith?
He is, or rather he was, a harmless old soul. He was a town drunk. He slept in the livery stable most of the time, and he supported himself by doing odd jobs around town. Some of the more generous folks used to feed him. I know Ms. Martin did.
I can't imagine anyone being so cruel as to want to hurt a poor man like Tui.
Johnny Purvis is that cruel. And the bad thing is, if we're to believe his note, it won't stop with Tui. He intends to kill again.
What are you going to do about it, Sheriff?
Well, for one thing, I intend to hire a couple of deputies to patrol the town at night. And for another, I'm going to ask you, Mitchum, and Miss Coyle to move in together.
Move in together?
Well, sort of together. You see, they're the only eyewitnesses to the bank robbery. We'll need their testimony in court in order to convict Carney. And I figure that Johnny knows this, which means he'll be trying to stop him.
Where do you plan for us to stay, Sheriff? With all the cattlemen in town, the hotel's filled.
I know. I haven't figured that out yet. I could put you all up at the jail, but I wouldn't want to have to do that.
They can all stay with me.
Why, Miss Martin, you don't have that kind of room, do you?
We can make that much room. My son and I can share his room. Miss Coyle can have my room. And I can put a cot up in the parlor for Mr. Mitchum. Mr. McAllister is already staying with me.
That's very good of you. I'll see to it that the county pays you.
I'm not worried about getting paid. I just want to see justice done.
How soon can they move in?
I can have everything ready within half an hour.
That night, the Martin household was host to far more than the night before. Kathleen Coyle and Claude Mitchum had joined the Martins and Falcon for supper.
I hate putting you out like this.
Oh, I don't mind. I just hope that you find your room comfortable.
Yes, it's quite comfortable, thank you.
Gordon reached for the potatoes.
Gordon, ask. Don't reach.
Can I have some more taters?
You mean may you have some more potatoes. And yes, you may.
Falcon, I can see now why you were so anxious to stay here instead of taking a room at the Gold Strike. It's so homey here.
Kathleen cast a lingering glance at Francis.
Oh, yeah, my stay here has been very pleasant.
Mr. McAllister, how long do you think we'll have to be here like this?
Just until after the trial, I should think, Mr. Mitchum.
I don't understand what the need was. I have a perfectly good room behind the bank. All of my things are there, my books, my Arrowhead collection, my pictures.
I know it's inconvenient, but the sheriff thinks that it'll be safer for us if we're all together.
I suppose he's right, but I, for one, will be glad when this trial is over and we can get back to our normal lives.
Are you running the bank now, Mr. Mitchum?
Yes, ma'am, I am. Mrs. Fraser asked me if I would. I'm interviewing people now to come work as a teller, but I'm sure you can understand that not just anyone can be a bank teller. It requires a person of mathematical skill and an even disposition. Young man, it's an occupation that you might pursue in your future.
No, sir. I'm sure it's a good job and all, but I want to be a railroad engineer just like my pa was.
Well, yes, of course. That is a very admirable position as well.
Poor Mrs. Fraser, losing her husband like that. I must call on her.
Yes, ma'am. Given that you lost your own husband, I'm sure you will be a great comfort to her.
Would you care for some more coffee, Mr. Mitchum?
Yes, ma'am, if you don't mind.
More coffee, Miss Coyle?
Yes, thank you.
I understand you're an entertainer, a singer.
Yes, well, I'm just singing in small places now. But one day I would like to perform in the theaters of New York.
Why New York?
Because that is the center of the theatrical world.
Oh, then I'm sure you will make it one day.
Oh, that's kind of you to say.
It was nearly midnight, and Falcon was asleep.
What's that?
Getting out of bed, Falcon moved to the bedroom door quickly, then opened it.
Francis, do you really think that...
That was as far as Falcon got. The woman in the nightgown, standing just outside his door, was not Francis. It was Kathleen Coyle.
Oh, my. Were you expecting someone else?
Falcon took a step into the hallway to block the door.
Oh, what are you doing here?
What am I doing here? I don't recall you asking me that question when I came to your hotel room in Miles City.
We aren't in a hotel now.
Well, aren't you going to invite me in? No more than I have on now. It's cold out here.
No, I'm not going to invite you in.
You invited me in before.
I know I did, but I shouldn't have. And it's not something I intend to ever do again.
Oh? What if I forced myself in, Falcon? Would you really make a scene?
Yeah, I would. Good night.
Kathleen stood alone outside the closed door for a moment, as if shocked that Falcon had shut her out. Then with a shrug, she turned and started back to her room. As Kathleen passed Gordon's room, his door opened slightly. Francis peeked out and saw the beautiful young woman wearing only a nightgown walking down the hallway to her door. Francis fought back tears as she closed the door.
You're awfully quiet this morning, Mrs. Martin.
Am I? I guess I just don't have anything to talk about, Mr. McAllister.
I hope the sheriff isn't expecting me to stay here all day. I have a bank to run.
I have to go to work as well. Sylvester isn't going to pay me to hang around here.
The sheriff said he would call for us this morning. I think he wants to have someone with us all the time, or at least until after the trial.
Mitchum took a watch from his pocket and examined it.
I hope he gets here soon. I'd like to be in the bank at least 1 hour before it opens.
I'm sure he will be.
With breakfast finished, Francis began picking up the plates and silverware. Falcon rose to help her.
No need for you to do this, Mr. McAllister. I can take care of it. I don't need any help.
Have you stopped to think that I might want to help?
Falcon continued gathering the settings from the table. He followed Francis into the kitchen and put the dishes down on the counter.
All right, what is it, Francis? What's going on?
Why should something be going on?
Come on now. Your voice is so sharp this morning it could cut paper. Are you nervous about us being here? Because if you are, I can certainly understand, but I'll talk to the sheriff about it.
No need for that. I'm not nervous about you being here.
Well, something's bothering you.
Look, why don't you just go into the parlor and keep Miss Coyle company? I'm sure after last night she must be wondering why you're paying so much attention to me.
After last night? What are you talking about?
I saw her.
You saw her? What did she say? What did she tell you?
She didn't tell me anything. She didn't need to. I saw her leaving your room.
Oh, so that's it.
Yes, that's it. I know I have no right to interfere with what you do. I mean, I told you that there could be nothing between us. But I do wish you would have more respect for me than to do something like that in me own house. All me son is here.
You saw her leaving. Did you see her go into my room?
What?
Did you see her go into my room?
No, but I saw her leave in your room and...
No, you didn't.
Mr. McAllister, don't tell me what I saw.
You saw her leaving, but you did not see her leave in my room.
But I...
You didn't see her come out of my room because she was never in it. She came to the room and knocked on the door, but I wouldn't let her in.
You didn't let her in?
No.
Oh.
Francis, you said yourself that there is nothing between us. So I have no reason to lie to you. If you want, I'll call Kathleen in here and have her tell you herself.
I can't believe that I let a little thing like that upset me so. Falcon, I'm sorry. I certainly have no right to question you about anything you do.
Falcon, is it? And not Mr. McAllister? Well, I'm glad you're calling me by my first name again. Mr. McAllister had a pretty cold ring to it.
Outside the window, Francis saw Sheriff Gibson and another man approaching her house.
The sheriff's here.
I better get out there. Excuse me.
Sheriff Gibson and one of his new deputies were approaching the front porch when Falcon stepped outside. Kathleen and Mitchum quickly joined him.
Folks, I want you to meet Deputy Edwards. He's going to be in the bank all day.
We don't have any money in the bank. Nobody's going to rob a bank that has no money.
I'm more interested in keeping you safe for now. You are a witness to a murder, remember?
How can I forget?
And Falcon, if you don't mind, I'd like you to hang around the saloon and keep an eye on Miss Coyle, at least until after the trial. That's not asking too much, is it?
No, that's not asking too much. Not at all.
With Gibson on one side and Deputy Edwards on the other side, the little party started back toward town from Francis's boarding house. They'd gone about 2 blocks when they saw Mr. Wales running up the road toward them.
Sheriff Gibson! Sheriff Gibson!
Yeah, Wales, what is it?
You better get down here, Sheriff. There's something you need to see.
Falcon, Kathleen, and Mitchum followed the sheriff and Wales into town. Wales led him up the narrow path between Wales' dry goods and clothing store and Emma's dressmaking shop. They stopped when they reached the back of the buildings.
He's over there.
Who's over there?
He's Troy Garrison, Sheriff.
And Troy Garrison? He works at the rolling mill, doesn't he?
Yes, sir. He's a shift foreman there. Good man, too. Miss Wales and I have had him over to our place more than once for supper.
Garrison was wearing coveralls and a red flannel shirt. He was lying face down in the alley, almost hidden by a clump of weeds. The way his feet were turned out at an odd angle and the stillness with which he was lying clearly indicated that he was dead.
When did you find him?
Just a couple of minutes ago. I had just swept up the store and come out back here to throw out the sweepings. That's when I saw him lying over there.
Did you touch him?
No, I yelled at him a couple of times just to see if he'd passed out back here or something. And when I didn't get no answer, I come to get you.
Sheriff Gibson rolled Garrison over onto his back. Like Keith, his throat had been cut. And like Keith, there was a note pinned to his chest.
This is number 2. If my brother isn't released by noon today, there will be more. Johnny Purvis. I don't mind telling you, Falcon, that this is one son of a bitch I would love to see hang. Begging your pardon, Miss Coyle, for the language.
Sheriff, I work in a saloon. I've heard such language before.
I should have killed him when I had the chance.
You mean when he robbed the bank?
No, I mean when he broke into Miss Coyle's room up in Miles City. What I don't understand is why the sheriff didn't keep him up there. You'd think breaking and entering would be at least 6 months.
Oh, well, that's my fault, I suppose.
Well, how is it your fault?
I didn't stop by the sheriff's office to press charges. I know I should have, but the whole experience was so unpleasant that I just didn't want to see him again. I guess, in a way, this is all my fault.
Don't blame yourself. You had no way of knowing how everything was going to turn out. And I can understand you're not pressing charges. I've had trouble myself getting people to press charges, either from fear or just because they didn't want to bother with the trial.
Still, I feel responsible.
Come on, Mr. McAllister. Let's get Mr. Mitchum and Miss Coyle where they're supposed to be. Then I can get Nunley down here to take care of the body. Nunley is doing quite a business lately.